Well, what I thought we could do is we wanted you to give us an overview of what happened and when and how it all came together. But when did you first get into the mortgage? When did you first start training mortgage brokers?
I first got into the mortgage business in 1988 and got no training because there was no need for or no requirement for any training.
Right.
And in fact, that situation wasn't resolved until just recently with the SAFE Act. Mm-hmm. Which requires training.
Yeah.
And so if we can make the distinction between the term mortgage brokers in the sense that mortgage brokers have a mortgage brokerage license like real estate brokers do,
right.
And they employ loan officers, so
right.
They are the employers.
Right.
And so I, for the most part, trained loan officers starting in the late 80s and in the early 90s as I continued to develop my career as a loan officer myself.
Yes.
And then I went pretty close to full-time starting at about 2002, I think.
Right.
I had the distinction of being the only trainer that I know of that trained for all the top training companies in the country, like loanofficerschool.com and the Mortgage Training Institute, Financial Strategies, Training Pro, Lender Training, all of these companies that competed with one another.
Right.
I trained for them and as a result became a better trainer and got exposed to all kinds of different companies. So I would train for AmeriQuest for one company.
Right.
Yeah, and for New Century and for Ditech. And then I would train individual loan officers who were looking to come into the business as well.
Right. And you also did like Countrywide.
I trained for Countrywide, both their A paper side. And Countrywide was never seen as an innovator. What they saw as a subprime boom continued is that they were getting eclipsed by their competitors. And so
right.
They created a company called Full Spectrum Lending.
Right.
And I was immediately brought on to train I'm reluctant to use the word dregs, but to bring on, you know, to train people who had no mortgage background whatsoever. They were late teens, early 20s, and they were, first job and out of high school or college. They had been flipping burgers, working at In-N-Out Burger. This is mostly a California and Texas phenomenon. And
what year?
Full Spectrum got really steamed up in about 2004, 2005. Really kind of late to the party. But,
right.
You know, Angelo Mozzillo and the management team there saw the numbers, saw what New Century was doing. And they also saw that New Century and AmeriQuest were getting these deals securitized and making huge amounts of money
right.
That Countrywide was not. And they felt that they owed it to their owners and stockholders and their employees to create Full Spectrum Lending, that it would have been derelict had they not done that.
And they had also promised that they would have a certain percentage growth of their market share.
That was what Countrywide was always after.
Yeah.
Again, they were never the first to the party, but they always wanted market share.
Right.
And with market share going to subprime, they felt left out.
Right.
When you say that they felt they would be derelict to their shareholders, did they ever say that?
I was never a Countrywide shareholder. Just from my reading of the trades and my knowledge of the business, if you've got a portion of the business that's booming, I guess the analogy I would make is, you know, General Motors selling, you know, SUVs, not good for the environment, but, you know, there's a huge demand for that, and I think you have to meet that demand. And so if you're, you know, running a publicly traded company like Countrywide, I think you would be derelict in your duty to your fiduciary duty to the shareholders.
Did they say that?
That's purely my speculation,
okay.
And my impression. Yeah.
But there was they really felt like they had to get a big operation up and going.
Yeah, because Countrywide, again, as you mentioned, in terms of market share, they were always late to the party, but you know, they would let others kind of innovate,
right.
and then they would kind of come on. So you would see that as, you know, time and again with different products. And the Countrywide would come on, and when they came on, it was with a huge push.
Right.
And they were determined, you know, Mozilla was very competitive. They were determined to show whatever New Century and AmeriQuest had done, that my sense of it was that we can do better. And so Full Spectrum got staffed up very quickly, and there were constant demands on me to train them in compliance. None of the subjects of compliance were of absolutely no interest to the loan officers that I trained.
Compliance with what?
Yeah, compliance with state and federal laws. So I was a sales and marketing trainer in terms of helping people to know how to sell these products mm-hmm. to, in some cases, frankly, unsophisticated and unsuspecting borrowers. And then I was also, unlike many sales and marketing trainers, I was and remain very strong in compliance. So compliance with RESPA, TIL, ECOA, all of the federal laws. And it was a challenge to me as a trainer because they had no interest in it whatsoever. I mean, AmeriQuest was really a sales operation. And so you would get guides like this that would talk about immediate production, immediate success. They wanted immediate production, and compliance with federal laws was secondary.
Can we make a copy?
Absolutely, yeah. That company is down the tubes. So,
yeah. Yeah. As our countrywide,
right?
When you say they had no interest in that, is there anything in writing, or email, or instructions, or contractual, or in any way that you still have?
No. What I'm saying is when I stood before a group of 20 or 40 or 50, or in the case of DITEC, 100 loan officers, I would always assume that there was a mystery shopper there from the state or the federal regulator, and so if it was 8 hours, I had to give them 8 hours. And so it was a constant battle, number one, to keep them awake, number two, to get them to come into the room and to come back from breaks. We call it, you know, managing loan officers is like pushing rope or herding cats. And when it doesn't involve commission, it is extremely difficult to get them to stay in the room.
Teaching lawyers ethics.
We would do these in large hotels, and hotels always give out USA Today.
Yes.
And I remember distinctly some of them would be in the back with USA Today, like reading, like while I'm talking, and I have to say, you've got to put down the newspaper, you've got to do it. And it was tough for me as a trainer, but I was being paid and paid well, so it didn't bother me. But they wanted to know how they can do more deals and how they can make more money, not how they can comply with federal laws that they either did not know or did not agree with.
What did you get any sense from the companies themselves whether they wanted? They had more interest in you selling marketing tools rather than compliance?
Well, I was brought in specifically for sales and marketing or for compliance, and never the twain shall meet. So that Countrywide would call me and say, we need you to come to Plano because we have X number of Illinois loan officers who have to be taught Illinois law so they can teach the Illinois, so they can pass the Illinois state exam.
Right.
Or they'd say, we need you to come to talk to them about how you can convert more leads into closed loans. So it was
right.
Either one or the other.
Right, right. How did the content of what you were teaching evolve? I mean, when did you first hear about these new products that they were going to be, and realize that they were actually going to be allowed to sell that?
It was a conversation with Jack Guttentag, the mortgage uh-huh. professor.
Yeah.
We were talking about these exotic products called Option Arms. And
remember what year that was?
It's probably 2004 or 2005, I'd have to say.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think one of the companies that I trained for asked me to come and talk about the Option Arms. And, you know, being a trainer, I'd say, sure, I'd be glad to. I hung up the phone and I said, what the heck are Option Arms? So, you know, I have to create a course on these products that I'd never heard of.
Right.
So I called Jack, who's got that wonderful website, that mortgage professor website.
Yeah.
And he explained to me, and then he talked about the fact that they were only fixed for the first 30 days, that they were essentially one-month arms.
Right.
And then I looked at a New Century rate sheet, and I saw that on an option arm, the higher the margin and the longer the prepayment penalty, the larger the commission. So that the worse loan you wrote for the borrower, the more money you would make.
Talk about the yield spread.
Yeah, the yield spread premium. Yeah, and I would you know this concept of yield spread premium is not an esoteric one. It's discussed on the front page of today's New York Times. There's a profile of Andrew Cuomo when he was HUD secretary. So that plus the Federal Reserve, which released the loan originator compensation rules about a week ago, this is a subject that people, I think, are reading about and that more people could probably understand than we think.
Do you have a copy of that document, that rate sheet?
I'm sure I can find one somewhere. When I taught for loan officer school, we would teach two-day, basically weekend classes, and I would have to teach people how to read a rate sheet. And I would teach them how to maximize your income. And so borrowers, they were concerned about rate, which was not anything to be concerned about on option ARM. It could start at 1% for the first month, and then after that turn into 2 or 3%. So they were accustomed to shopping for rate, but they really needed to shop for margin. And that tutorial on the Mortgage Professor website talks about option ARMs and how to shop for option ARMs. But the borrowers are most concerned about cash to close and monthly income. And after that, they have no concern whatsoever, even though they should. So I'll try to dig up one of those rate sheets. I don't want to say my job, but as what I would do is I would explain that the higher the margin and the longer the prepayment penalty, the more money you will make in commission. And you will be able to do that without the borrower understanding that. The borrower that will be fully disclosed. The prepayment penalty, I always joke in my classes that 100% of borrowers with prepayment penalties don't know they have them, even though they will sign the prepayment penalty rider with the promissory note, but they don't know what a prepayment penalty is. That's number one. And number two is that the margin, we never disclose the rate sheet. It was always an internal document. And so you could give them a margin of 2 or 3 or 4, and the higher the margin, so you have the index, you know, the base, the index, plus the margin, which is essentially the spread of the profit margin. And so the higher the margin, the more money you would make in yield spread premium. And again, YSP would be disclosed on the HUD-1 and the GFE. But the way that I taught people and that settlement agents would do it, they would say, well, look, this says $7,000 to ABC Mortgage Company. And then you say to the borrower, don't worry, you're not paying that. And technically, they're right because they weren't writing a check for $7,000, but because of the higher interest rate or higher, you know, prepayment penalty or higher margin, they were in effect paying that.
So people would just be quickly reassured that they weren't paying it when they were actually paying it indirectly.
Yeah, indirectly. So, yeah. And if what they were looking for was a yes because they needed to get into the home, they were looking for, can I meet this monthly payment this month?
Right.
I'll worry about next month. And do I have enough money for closing costs? And if all of that is a yes, where do I sign?
Right.
It was almost willful ignorance on the part of
the borrower. What about instances where the broker was putting people into unconventional products when they would qualify for a conventional product?
Yeah.
Just to get the increased YSP.
I think now we need to move to the issue of client versus customer. I'm a member of the Upfront Mortgage Brokers Association. It's upfrontmortgagebrokers.org. We have for years gone with a flat fee. You pay us $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000, and we'll get you a loan.
Mm-hmm.
We won't keep the YSP. You are our client, to whom we owe a fiduciary duty. However, when you come to me, and this was alluded to in the New York Times article this morning, when you come to me as a typical loan originator or mortgage broker, I'm going to call you my client, and then I'm going to treat you like my customer. And I have no fiduciary duty to you whatsoever to get you the best deal or the most reasonable deal or the most appropriate loan.
So you're making a distinction here between where you'd like the industry to go and what you're part of the movement to do. But let's go back to what the reality is for
right.
most people. The reality right. for most people is that they believe that they're someone's client. They're
right.
actually their customer.
Yep.
And it's in the interest of the salesperson there to get them into the product that's going to get them the highest yield spread premium.
The reason I was kicked off the board of the Maryland Association of Mortgage Brokers was because I did an interview with the Baltimore Sun. And I said, you should look at us the same way you look as car salespeople. And so I was unceremoniously booted off the board. I've got a letter from the board. I think it was 2007 or 2008. I said we are. Yes,
and that was when Maryland mortgage brokers were grossly unregulated, correct?
Well, I mean, that's the issue. One of the things, and I think the industry has a good point, is that we are not unregulated, grossly or not. but we are unenforced. And so I have conducted classes for ARMR and CSBS. Are you all familiar with ARMR and CSBS here? ARMR, Conference of State Bank Supervisors, and ARMR is kind of their little brother, the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators. They're two trade associations, both here in D.C. And so most of the regulators, the street level, across the table regulators, have zero mortgage experience. They're under or untrained. They're underpaid and overworked. And so and so the state regulators were asleep at the switch, as were the federal regulators, the so-called RESPA police. And there's also a very strong, here in Washington, a very strong group of mortgage banking attorneys who know the law, who know the weaknesses of HUD and the weaknesses of the state regulators and the weaknesses of the Federal Reserve, and defend their clients aggressively, to the point that there are very few findings against them and very few fines.
Well, you talk about weak regulations. Right. I know that in 2003 and again in 2009, FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, tried to subject mortgage brokers along with realtors and others involved in real estate settlement transactions.
Right.
Tried to make them subject to the Bank Secrecy Act and file SARs.
Yeah.
And the mortgage broker, National Association of Mortgage Brokers, resisted that both times in great length, citing increased costs. It's going to drive, you're going to put mortgage brokers out of business.
It's always the refrain of the NAMB. It'll put us out of business. It never comes to pass, but that's what they always said. They would always say, if you do this, you will put us out of business.
Somebody tried to regulate them.
Yeah.
But
it's interesting. Again, the New York Times article this morning alludes to the fact that there was a time when the National Association of Mortgage Brokers was a powerful lobby. They are a shell of themselves. They recently revealed that they represent less than 10% of mortgage brokers, and the membership fee is only about $100 or $200 a year. And they just lost their office. They now don't even have an office. They're operating out of their homes.
So what's happened there is the group just cratered because there are so much fewer mortgage brokers?
That's one of the reasons, but as I kind of, as a part-time reporter, when I covered especially hearings of the Senate Banking Committee, the NAMB made what I believe was both a strategical and tactical error by saying, these loans might be bad, but you can't blame us for that. We didn't create these loans, we didn't fund them, and we didn't approve them. All we did was sell them. And really the analogy there is, we may be selling heroin on the street corner, but we didn't grow the heroin, and we didn't create the heroin or create the demand.
And
we didn't use it, and we're completely innocent. And furthermore, we didn't force anybody to use it. So don't blame us for anything. There's no contributory negligence. And I heard the whispers in the audience. I saw the hard jaws set among the members of the House Financial Services Committee and the Senate Banking Committee. And slowly but surely, the NAMB lost all credibility on the Hill, to the point that a few months ago, maybe about 6 or 8 months ago, there was a hearing of the House Financial Services Committee. There were three panels, and the NAMB was like the fifth speaker on the third panel when none of the members was left. So the NAMB, unfortunately for them, has no credibility on the Hill, in my opinion.
But isn't that always just a standard reply of the mortgage brokers that, well, we're not dealing the heroin, but in essence, what they were doing kind of contributed to a lot of the problem, because they didn't care if the loan defaulted. They didn't care if the loan got securitized, and then the whole portfolio goes downhill.
Well, BB&T recently announced that they are withholding 10% of loan officers' compensation, mortgage loan officers' compensation, for a year, and they will be paid that 10% if and only if the loans perform. So for the first time that I can remember, there is finally a direct relationship between origination and loan performance, at least at BB&T, which is the sixth or seventh largest originator in the country, a larger branch banking and trust
out
of Wilson, North Carolina. Changing incentives from quantity to quality. And they reported in, I think, Origination News, they said they have not lost any top producers, that the attitude is we'd be glad to be measured on quality.
Well, let me add, going back to incentive.
And performance.
As a mortgage broker, what's your incentive if you find a loan that somebody comes in with their third loan application of the week for their third different house with their third different set of income documents?
Right.
What's the incentive for that mortgage broker to not close that loan?
It's a disincentive. It's a disincentive because if you don't close that loan, you don't make a commission. So your intent is whether it's fraudulent or not, if you can get it by the underwriter, who you believe holds the ultimate responsibility, if you can get it by the underwriter, you can't be accused of that loan performing badly, because you met all the underwriter guidelines. You had an underwriter stamp that approved. All you did was present the package to them for them to say yes or no. You have no liability whatsoever there.
Well, was there a concern among the brokers that they were seeing this come in and it's like kind of, oh, it means that, you know, sounds like they were buying for the, it's not my job award.
Yeah, absolutely none whatsoever. In fact, as I said, there was a disincentive. If you worry too much about the macro, if you worry too much about the economy and whether that loan was suitable for a borrower, maybe you didn't pay the rent that month, or maybe you didn't make the commission. You had no incentive whatsoever to be concerned about the quality of the loan, whether it was suitable for the borrower, or whether the loan performed. In fact, you were, in a way, encouraged not to worry about those macro issues. You had a kind of sort of duty to the borrower. They came to you, they want to buy a house, the homes are going up in value, and you would be doing a disservice to them if you didn't get them into that home. You'd be doing a disservice to yourself and to your family if you didn't get that loan closed and generate a commission. That was the attitude. And caring about whether the loan would perform and whether it would result in a depression or a recession was just completely beyond their realm. It was just not an issue for them.
But some of you did think about it.
I don't know when mortgage brokers, I mean, we got together, there were these huge conferences. This was the NAMB conference in Las Vegas in 2007. Las Vegas, taking it to the extreme. That's what the theme of it was, taking it to the extreme. We weren't concerned about the bigger issues. NAMB reigns. In other words, we control the market. At one time, mortgage brokers had 60 or 70% market share.
How many mortgage brokers were there?
I think that at the height, NAMB had 25 or 28,000 members. Now, this is mortgage brokers. Mm-hmm. They also had a loan officer membership, and they might be able to tell you more. Now, having said that, brokers are a very individualistic lot, and I don't think that NAMB at any point ever had more than 15 or 20%, according to their numbers, of the mortgage brokers as members. So what you would do is you would be able to go back to the states. Most states, Colorado and Alaska came late. It wasn't until a few years ago that Colorado and Alaska actually regulated loan mortgage brokers. Maryland doesn't have a mortgage broker's license. It's a mortgage lender's license, so it's tough to break that out. But you could look and see, you know, a particular states, you know, combine all the states and territories in the district, how many mortgage broker licenses were issued, and then compare them to the numbers. It was always difficult for NAMB to get people to join. They were just not
enjoying it. Let me keep going on this. So you think there were over 200, close to 300,000 brokers?
That number doesn't seem unreasonable. There's a guy up in Columbia. Have you heard of the Wholesale Access?
No.
Used to be Tom LaMalfa, and you know Tom, you heard that name?
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to think of his, David Olson. You heard of David Olson?
Mm-hmm.
I think the website is wholesaleaccess.com. And he specialized in counting mortgage brokers over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And David can give you very reliable information over the years. And let's just say he's just up in Columbia. He's interviewed a lot.
Right. How many of the people that were coming in, you talked about, what was it, Full Spectrum or whatever it was. You're saying that they were really people, really greeting people. Is it, how long did you see that at a lot of, I mean, as the market was surging,
right,
and they just needed to get as many people out on the street,
right,
selling these as possible. Is this what you saw?
It was the warm body syndrome. It was, you know, wherever we have to recruit from, we've got people that are calling in, and we have got more leads than we have loan officers to generate them. And there was at the time no or little licensing, very few barriers. Now, as a the result of the SAFE Act and the nationwide mortgage licensing system, it's going to cost you about $1,000 as a loan officer before you can get into the business.
Let me understand this.
Yes, sure.
So the perspective of a mortgage lender that relied on brokers was, we have all these leads. Where were the leads coming from? Those were consumer calls?
Right. DITECH would be advertising, and still is, you know, constantly on the phone. and they had 400 loan officers. They were consistently, they called them loan agents, consistently firing and hiring.
Why firing?
They would give a particular loan officer 20 leads that day, and only three of them resulted in closed loans, whereas somebody else might be able to close five loans out of those 20 leads. It was vicious. It was.
All right, so let's take the 300,000, 200,000, whatever the number
is. Now, again, I think we can't confuse between brokers and loan officers, because there were probably 500,000 or 600,000 loan officers.
Those are the in-house people.
Yeah, those are the individual street level kind of, like, there's real estate agents and real estate brokers. So real estate brokers have a different license, and mm-hmm. they can hire real estate agents. Mm-hmm. Mortgage brokers have a mortgage broker's license, and then they can hire loan officers.
Oh, so loan officers work for the brokers,
yes.
Not for a lender.
Not for a lender.
In-house. What do you call the in-house person?
And sometimes they do. I mean,
sometimes they're called loan officers.
Yeah, loan officers, loan agents.
Yeah, it depends on the company. It depends on
loan counselors.
But I want to go farther. 200 to 300,000 brokers. So
sounds about right.
How much did they make, and what was the distribution, and how much they made? What distinguishes a successful one from an unsuccessful one?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it is income in terms of success. It wasn't loan performance. So I don't have figures on average. I mean, Department of Labor might be able to help you with that. I don't have figures on average. I can tell you that, you know, the goal would be on, especially on subprime. I mean, we used to have these guys before the passage of HOPA in 1994. We called them 10-point Tonys. And their attitude was, you know, you made 10 points on a deal. That was before the passage of HOPA, Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act, which included those eight
lenders. But if a lot of these people are burning out because they can only close 3 out of 10 loans or whatever,
right?
Of this 200 to 300,000, how many stayed in business for any period of time, and how many were just washing through before they went to aluminum siding or something,
right? That would be a good number to know. I don't know. I know that, especially within full spectrum and subprime, there was tremendous turnover, because these were not career committed loan officers. These were opportunists. Whether it was a refi boom or the subprime boom, we needed those warm bodies to handle the temporary increase in volume.
So the brokers hired their own loan officers.
The brokers hired their own loan officers, and then you had Countrywide or Full Spectrum hiring loan officers.
So what entity would have tracked, would there be any entity that would have tracked who was employed when?
I mean, Countrywide might have some internal numbers, B of A, and they might be
able to, you know, like in terms of turnover. Yeah. But Countrywide and Century wouldn't track if they were working with, say, you know, Joe Schmo mortgage broker.
Oh yeah,
they would know who was employed by them.
No, but I in terms of turnover.
No one's on salary. Everyone's on commission.
Yeah, it's almost
so
all
they're all
commission.
Independent contractors.
Right.
There's no need to track how many come and go.
They get paid based on work.
You eat what you kill, and that was basically it.
If we could go back to the client versus customer.
Sure. It's a fight that I've been waging for 20 years and have lost for the past 20 years.
At what point during all this did the brokers come to work for the lender as opposed to working for the customer?
Always. I mean, there was never, your ultimate duty was to the lender. That's who kind of sort of you, not represented in a fiduciary or legal way, but that was your source of income. And if you got cut off from Countrywide or Wells Fargo, you know, or New Century, and you didn't want that, because that was the spigot, that was the source of the funds that you could close those loans. So you had no duty of fiduciary, legal, ethical, moral to the borrower at all, aside from the fact that you called them a client and you would say things like, "We'll shop the rate for you," which implied fiduciary.
A real estate broker works for the seller.
Right.
Does a mortgage broker work for the lender in the same way?
It might be a fiduciary. I owned a mortgage brokerage in North Carolina, and I'm trying to think if I have any of those contracts. I signed contracts that would basically indicate that I had the duty of disclosure of, you know, I don't know what other duties, but that I would sign contracts with the lenders, but never with the borrower.
But if I come to you and say, I need a loan,
right,
isn't there some sort of implied, you're working for me?
Absolutely. There is. And that's what the New York Times article alluded to. And yet, in the end, it wasn't. I mean, for instance, this concept of buyer agency in real estate, the issue of sub-agency has gone out over the past 10 or 15 years. But until 15 or so years ago, when buyer agency really came to the fore, if you were a real estate broker and you got a listing at Coldwell Banker and somebody from REMAX was working with the buyer, that REMAX agent had a fiduciary duty to the seller because of sub-agency, not to the buyer, even though the buyer would be revealing all of this information. Mm-hmm. And that was clearly seen as something that's just, in this age of consumer empowerment, not acceptable. So, unfortunately, that deception continues to this day in the mortgage broker field. And we, as mortgage originators and mortgage professionals, consistently imply that we're on the side of the borrower.
When you say you call it deception because the consumer is not aware of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's either self-deception because the consumer doesn't know or doesn't care because they think that they're on their side. And I think it's lack of the mortgage broker and the loan officer being forthcoming and saying, hey, by the way, you know, I'm not working for you. I'm working for Wells Fargo, which is providing them.
But there's no required disclosure of that. I mean, if I'm a real estate agent, yeah. I'm required to disclose that, because I've been through this several times.
Right.
Yeah. Especially if, you know, it's a weird deal where the agent's representing the seller. And,
right.
You know, if they're listing the house, like, they have to say, listen, I'm representing the seller on this one,
right.
Not you.
I think some states have a disclosure. NAMB, for 10 or 15 years, on their website, NAMB.org, has had, it's kind of buried, but has had a proposed disclosure that basically says, I'm not working for you, but most loan officers don't give it to borrowers. There's really no incentive to say, hey, by the way, I'm not working for you.
You know, I might, you know, what, yeah, yeah. And they'll just go to somebody else, yeah. Who'll say, I'm working for you,
yeah.
and then do the same,
yeah.
Thing too.
And you can kind, yeah. Of see the analog of that, which is if you go to upfrontmortgagebrokers.org, you will see the agreement that we sign with borrowers that says, I am working for you. As opposed to, so that's the positive, as opposed to the lack of a disclosure for most borrowers.
Now,
so,
yeah. Can you talk about kind of the two-way stream? I know the brokers are supposed to go to the lenders to get the loan, but
right.
I know there were instances, and I don't know how widespread it was, of the lenders coming to the brokers.
Oh, constantly. I mean, this...
I mean, I can tell you that there were, you know, at least in Maryland, there were lenders that were coming and hanging out at brokers' offices saying, hey, I want your business.
Those were AEs, wholesale account executives. And they, I mean, some of them could make six figures a month. It was an incredibly profitable time for wholesale account executives. That they would have a list they'd obtained from the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation in Baltimore, mm-hmm. of all licensed mortgage brokers. And sometimes he would have four and five AEs coming into the office.
But you call them wholesale?
Wholesale, they're called AEs, account executives.
Account executives.
Yeah.
And they were fishing.
Absolutely, because...
So they would just get the list from DLLR, yeah. And then start basically cold calling?
Oh, yeah, cold calling. And you would go, I mean, basically NAMB was funded by Countrywide and Wells Fargo and wholesalers. You would go to these things, you would see, well, here's an ad. This is from Mortgage Originator Magazine. This is City Financial. And this is City advertising to loan officers saying, we've got money, send us your loans. We want to underwrite and fund your loans. If you go through any of these publications, you will see all kinds of, here's lending art. This is who basically have funded. Oh, here's U.S. Mortgage, stronger than ever. So that's what the whole thing.
It's one thing to advertise in a magazine, and yeah. Then, you know, it's kind of up to the broker to call that number, whether they call Countrywide or U.S. Bank.
Right.
But it's a different thing for the wholesale account executive to actually show up at the mortgage broker's door. Is there some sort of impropriety in that? I mean, it would seem to me that there would be, especially if there's the implied that the broker is actually working for the borrower as opposed to the lender.
Should
the stream be one way, or should that two-way stream be allowed to continue?
The way that I saw it is that an account rep would be coming in to tell me about new programs that they had. And then I would say, well, look, you know, your pricing is way off. You know, I mean, I can't use you. Countrywide had a reputation for accepting just about anything, but their pricing was never that good. So I would, you know, throw loans to Countrywide, to First Union or Wachovia or whatever, wouldn't approve them. But I always appreciated visits. They would always have, you know, pens and gugas, and they always buy you lunch. You know what I mean? They always buy you lunch. They'd come in, and you'd see them once a month, and you know, twice a month if you were a big producer. And so,
like a pharmaceutical rep.
A pharmaceutical rep. That's exactly what it was. You know, get clocks and stuff. And, yeah.
I'd like to, unfortunately, I'm back to run another interview in about 10 minutes. But
okay.
Stated income loans.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Can you talk a little about that process and what happened and why borrowers would think that they could just state their income?
Because we would advertise stated income, no 4506T. And the 4506T was an IRS form, which would allow us as the lender to go directly to the IRS, independent of the borrower, to get their income information.
You would advertise to whom?
To wholesale reps would advertise to loan officers and mortgage brokers. And then the loan officers would advertise to borrowers that you state your income, and we won't make you sign a 4506T. Therefore, we will not be able to go to the IRS to determine if you're lying to us.
So when a borrower comes in with an annual income of $14,000, uh-huh, and sits down with a broker on the basis of an advertisement that says we're not checking with the IRS,
right,
and that loan gets processed as $150,000 income, what happened between the borrower and the broker?
Well, now that's fraud. I mean, you know, many times we would coach the loan officers and the borrowers to say, when they started saying, I'm making, don't tell me. In fact, what happened is we would submit, inexperienced loan officers would submit the application form on stated income loans with income in there or with a pay stub. And then the account executive would intercept that, send it back to us and say, resubmit without a pay stub, without bank statements if there was direct deposit into the bank account, because we don't want to know, and with the application form completely clean of any income information. It's like, don't tell us, we're not listening, we don't want to hear.
Is that a pattern?
Well, on stated income,
did that happen once in a while?
Well, I mean, once you knew what the underwriter wanted and didn't want, if it was a stated income loan, don't state income. I mean, it was just, you know, it may have taken a little while for when they first came out, we would say, okay, here's the income. An underwriter would say, did you not hear what we just said? It's a stated income loan. Don't tell us what the borrowers are making. Whatever they say they're making, we're going to believe because we bow before the FICO God. And if their FICO score was high enough, then stated income is fine.
So I don't understand.
Sure.
Stated income means the borrower states their income.
Uh-huh.
But if I heard you right, the broker was saying, "Don't tell me."
Right. Well, no, don't give me any documentation. Just tell me what you make. Just state what you make. I will put that on there, and I will believe it, and so will the underwriters.
So if I'm unhappy about that, as somebody looking at what happened to the financial system, where do I put the onus? On the broker or the borrower or both?
What brokers, well, certainly if it's a lie, you have to put it on the person who lied, and that's the borrower. Because if you're a broker or a loan officer and the borrower says, I make $10,000 a month, and it's a stated income loan, and you have met all of the conditions that New Century has told you must meet, then your perception is you are not liable in any way, because the underwriter underwrote it and approved it. And so whether it was reasonable or unreasonable,
but
so long as you met the requirements.
How do you underwrite something with no backup documentation?
They relied on FICO. They relied on, you know, maybe on assets. So there were different levels. There was a CISA, S-I-S-A, which was stated income, stated asset. Then there was a SINA, which is a stated income, no asset. Then there was a VISA, verified income, stated asset, all these things. And then it got down to what's called a NINJA, which is a no income, no job, no asset.
And well, so that was NINJA a joke, or were they processing those things?
Well, no, that was serious. I mean, that we did not know want to know your job, your income, or your assets. If you agreed to pay the interest rate and you were putting X amount down and you had a FICO score of X amount, we had people who could securitize that loan, and we had investors in India or China who were willing to buy tranches based on that securitization.
So you wouldn't have an improper conversation with the borrower. They wouldn't need to state anything.
Right. Right. If they told you make $14,000 a year and you say, look, in order to qualify for this loan, you've got to report $150,000, that's a clear case of fraud. That's
the judgment of how often that happens.
don't know. I would imagine that it happened as often as a loan officer who wasn't career minded could get away with it. In terms of the numbers, I just don't know. I guess you'd have to look for the whiteout.
Can you tell us about some of the other kinds of loans? So we've got these ninjas, we've got interest only. Could you go through the different kinds of loans and tell us what you call them internally?
Sure. Neg-am loans, I always taught loan officers never to use the term negative amortization. Mm-hmm. Use the term deferred interest or optional payment of interest.
Uh-huh.
In other words, push the power to the borrower. That and furthermore, if negative amortization did happen, don't worry, the home is going to go up in value and we'll just refinance you in a couple of years.
Right.
So it was the pay option arm.
So there's negative am, you said interest only. Interest only would be another one.
I have seen some numbers that 90% of Americans with pay option arms chose the neg-am option.
And then, do you have copies of any of your slides or whatever you used in these classes that we could use as examples?
I'll look through my computer. I have an older laptop, and I'll look through and be glad to provide any slides that I have.
That would be really helpful. Yeah, and we could see what.
Because that means we're taking it.
Yes, that's right.
We can then get the picture as of 2004, 2005, whenever it was.
Right.
Rather than having to sort of judge retrospectively. So that would be wonderful.
And this is an ad from Loan City, which was a wholesaler. Finally, an option arm you'd put your mother in. This was in response to the concern that, you know, that you would only put anybody that you didn't like into an option arm, and this is your copy, that the option arms are so good. To answer your question before you go, we moved from using an option arm as a financial planning tool only for the fairly wealthy to an affordability product to help people who couldn't otherwise buy a home to get into a home.
And when did that move? More or less.
I'm sorry, Chris Cruz, nice to meet you.
I would say
2005, 2006 when the securitization really started ramping up.
Yeah.
What would happen is every few months we would get bulletins from New Century and from Countrywide and from AmeriQuest in which the requirements to get approved for the loan were deteriorating to the point that New Century did an option arm 80-20, in other words, no money down, no income, no asset, down to a 580 FICO. Which
has that in writing again? To get any of these documents would be phenomenally.
Yeah, they're floating around.
To put in a.
I should have brought that, and I'll be glad to bring those back in. I'll look for the. And these were all available. In fact, I would encourage you to just go to Google and type in New Century rate sheets. Who knows what might be out there still?
Right.
Do you? Okay, yeah, Indy Mac as well.
Actually, we got it from Illinois Attorney General.
Okay.
Yeah, we
did. Do you? Okay.
Oh, that's then our. Then we got those. Okay.
In that, yes.
But we would. It was basically we called them liar loans and fog of mirror loans. Stick a mirror.
Not in your class.
Yeah. Well, no. That's the thing. In the class, and we would joke about that because I mean, as a trainer, I would train people how to do the loans that were available out there. That they were coming to me, and my sort of fiduciary duty as a trainer was. They were like, man, there's a real boom going on. I'm paying you $595 for this weekend class. Tell me how to make millions as a mortgage loan officer, and that was my duty. You want to make the most money, don't do a 30-year loan. Do an option arm, charge the highest margin that you can get away with and the longest prepayment penalty that you can get away with. And instead of making 1 point on the back, you can make 4 points on the back. And you have no fiduciary duty to your customer whatsoever. There were some students who were mortified by that, but I felt, you know, and I was like, wow, this is pretty ethical. And then there were other students who were like, man, tell me more. How do I do this? Because, again, there was no connection to performance.
Was there a concern in the industry about that, though, that you were calling these things liar loans?
Yes. We never did. I did because I'm a very blunt person. But, you know, within the industry, you didn't. And you will see some old NAMB documents that says, you know, we're concerned about these. And, you know, these might. I mean, but even in this book, it talked about the responsible use of of exotic or non-traditional loans. Hey, you're stupid to not buy a house. That was the perception among the Republican and Democratic administrations. If you don't buy a house, what a damn fool you are.
And brokers and lenders were working in some ways together to develop the products all the time?
Well, I mean, we as brokers, they were kind of being pushed down to us, but we didn't object to them. Because the more these, thank you, sir, my pleasure. The more these products existed, the more commission money we would make.
But I mean, did it work both ways?
No, I never got the sense that we were strong in terms of product development. We would certainly communicate with the wholesale reps that, look, if we had this product, we could do more loans. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could bring us a product, by the way, you know, we play them off against each other. Countrywide has got, you know, we can do FICOs down to 620. And then the next month he'd come back and we can do FICOs down to 600.
They just needed to feed the beast.
Yeah, feed the beast.
They had the ability to sell them. They just needed people to deliver warm bodies.
It was a race to the bottom. Race to the bottom. It was the we're going to give everybody in America who's going to fog a mirror a loan.
Right.
And these products are going to help us.
Was that related to housing goals, or was that just
the race to
the bottom?
It was. I mean, we knew. I mean, historically, I mean, in 1940, the housing homeownership was about 40%. By 1985, it had been up to like 64-65%. If you look at the numbers from when we went from 65 to 69 in the past decade, that is, I think, where we really went wrong. Is it looks like the historical average in this country is 65% of us are homeowners at any given time, and the other 35 are either not mentally, emotionally, or financially prepared for homeownership. And that we told people who were renting, you're stupid to rent. And even if they were happy renting, and even if they weren't financially ready to buy, we say, look, okay, you got no money down, you got bad credit, you don't have a job, we can still get you into a home. And don't worry, because even if you can't make the payments, we'll rewrite the loan, and the home will go up in value in the next couple of years. You'll make a mint. Foolish to rent. That was the end.
When did you start thinking a little bit more holistically about this whole problem?
I think when I started attending some of the hearings, I would be honest with you that a couple of years ago when the crash started, I wrote a column. I'll try to find it. I was a member of a group called the National Association of Responsible Loan Officers. And I said, don't worry. This is, you know, never in American history have home prices gone down in value. Therefore, since it never has happened, it never will happen. It was clearly faulty logic.
How did it happen that you contacted me, Chris? So you did contact me.
You know, I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe a comment on something I'd written or something?
I think it might have been. I mean, I'm kind of a copy editor or a corrector at heart, and maybe we were talking about something. And, as a reporter, certainly not at your level, but I know the pressures of reporters, and sometimes, you know, you're not fed stuff, but you have sources, and I guess I was trying to become especially in Washington, especially the Post, even though they've gotten away from it, a lot of the sources tend to be official and government. And I think my sense was, can I please give you a street level view of what's going on here?
Yeah,
that was
right.
Probably that I thought there was some value to that.
Right. I think it was maybe after we got the first loan performance numbers and we were seeing how the market was increasingly going in this direction.
Yeah.
And I think you called me and you knew that the loans were going to go bad.
Well, when we were, you know, going down to 580 FICO, you just knew that people couldn't continue to make those payments, that people, that not only were inappropriate people becoming loan officers, but I guess to answer your question, I was concerned about being condescending and paternalistic to say, you can't own a home. When what I realized was sometimes the best thing we could say to people is, you can't own a home. That is not right for you right now. And we were never trained to do that. And it was very difficult. It's very difficult for somebody to come to your office and say, and then you say to them, I don't think you're ready to buy a home right now. I mean, that doesn't help me. It doesn't help them. That's what my perception was. But there's a lot of people now with terrible credit, with foreclosures, with defaults, who will not be able to buy a home for many years.
So, in fact, they sat down with you with no advocate for them.
Absolutely not. I was a car salesman, mm-hmm. and I was trying to get them to pay the most for the car. And the least sophisticated they were, the more money I could make from them. So there was and still is no advocate.
And the word would get around about that, and they would send their friends and neighbors and relatives?
Yeah. It's funny because It didn't matter what they paid, it only mattered that they could get approved. And so if you got a reputation within the industry as being somebody who could approve loans, I mean, that kind of happened with Wells Fargo in Baltimore. As you know, there's a federal class action suit that Baltimore has initiated because of reverse redlining. And so it was primarily in black neighborhoods. And so far they've lost the first round, but it was primarily in black neighborhoods. And so the word would get out that a particular broker in that neighborhood had approved this borrower, and you knew them, and they hadn't had a job, they were on welfare, you know what I mean, the credit was terrible, no down payment. Then you said, well, if you know they can get a loan, I can get a loan. So yeah,
let me ask you about the widespread use of the state income loan, because historically it was meant for a certain
doctor, lawyer,
a certain branch of the population.
Right, very small branch.
Why was it expanded to basically include everybody, especially the guy who has, you know, down the street who hasn't worked in 3 months,
right,
and is coming to the broker and, you know, clearly probably doesn't look like he should qualify for a stated income loan.
Right.
But people were qualifying.
Well, you didn't qualify for stated income. That's just the thing. There was the qualification element was taken out of it. There was no qualification involved. It was, are you alive and can you sign? You know what I mean? So when you state your income and state your assets, there's no underwriting really going on there, other than maybe a credit score.
And you didn't actually have to speak English?
Well, no, and to this day, there are people who, you know, that's kind of an issue within compliance, is if they can't speak English or if they're blind or, you know, I mean, your Truth in Lending Act requires any disclosures that you make, you know, you allow people to bring a translator. But no, I mean, it didn't matter what language you spoke. And in fact, one of the things that many of the white loan officers were mortified by, I don't know if it was called affinity fraud, but that Hispanic loan officers would screw Hispanic borrowers, black loan officers would screw black borrowers. And so what I would teach in classes, I would say, purely as a capitalist, I would say, if you're Hispanic, do you owe Hispanic borrowers a greater sense of loyalty than non-Hispanic borrowers? And most loan officers would say no. And I would joke, I'd always get a big laugh, even to this day, you should screw everybody equally, I guess was my attitude.
You would say that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, and not screw, but treat people, everybody equally. So if you were Hispanic, you would go to a Hispanic loan officer and let your guard down, because you'd like, oh, you know, he's from my, you know, from, you know, he's Hispanic, I'm Hispanic, they're going to treat me okay. But what I would try to tell borrowers is, he's not Hispanic, he's a loan officer. And that's how you interact with him. The most important color in mortgages is green. And so that if you're a black borrower and you go to a black loan officer, don't expect them to treat you better because you're black. You would be doing yourself a disservice if you let your guard down.
But is that because of the perceived, you're working for me?
Yeah, and I tell black and Hispanic and white loan officers and Korean and Vietnamese loan officers, do not treat people of your own ethnic group better than you treat anybody else. In the first place, it's a violation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. But in the second place, you're a capitalist first. Close the loan. And in fact, you know, you might get a reputation if you treat people in your, you know, ethnic group better. You might get a reputation, but ultimately, it's about closing the loan.
I'm not here to teach you all this, so you can get soft at the end.
Yeah, that's right. It's you know, and I do joke. I say screw everybody equally, but really, what I meant was treat everybody equally.
Right.
And if you're Hispanic, don't give a Hispanic borrower a better deal just because they're Hispanic. It's a violation of ECOA, and it's a violation of the rules of capitalism.
How about any other kinds of things? Did you ever hear anybody express any concerns about things like trolling for clients in churches?
Well, you know, we would teach people how to get borrowers. I mean, it's funny because you use that word clients, you know, and that's kind of a generic, but I, you know, absolutely, if you think about churches is a great way. I should have brought a book. There's a book called 101 Ways to Originate Mortgage Loans. Is that, you know, get close to people, join meetup groups, join, you know, lead groups. There were some people who wore name tags, some people who had magnetic signs on their cars.
Mm-hmm.
Go into the neighborhoods, like I said, if you know, the Wells Fargo was accused of funding the brokers who went into the black neighborhoods in Baltimore with, again, what was called reverse redlining, where you would take prime borrowers and give them subprime loans.
Yeah.
And that if the borrowers, I mean, Countrywide had, there was a big issue that that the people would apply to full spectrum lending for a loan. They could qualify for an A paper or prime loan, but they didn't go to full spectrum. They didn't go to Countrywide, they went to full spectrum.
Right.
And so finally Angela Mozzillo had to come out and say, look, if they qualify for A paper, that's what we're going to write them. But if you went to AmeriQuest, which was only a subprime lender, and you qualified for A paper, they would write you a subprime loan.
Right.
Because you were foolish enough or unsophisticated enough to come to AmeriQuest.
Okay, so AmeriQuest is pretty much where everybody, as far as you're aware, almost everybody got a bad loan.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting word, bad. I mean, some people would say that it allowed them to pull out equity. Others would say that, you know, that it caused them to go into foreclosure. Mm-hmm. Or that it, you know, helped them to, I mean, if you look, I mean, if, you know, clear, just like anything else, you don't talk about the cost of the loan, you talk about the benefits. Why did you come here today? You need a new car? We can get that for you. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to put your kid through college? We can get that for you. You've got equity. Use your equity. Your equity, one of the things that, I guess I made some notes, one of the things that people will talk about is if any equity you have in your home is dead equity. It's not doing anything for you. And you're stupid to have equity in your home. Rick Edelman, who's a financial planner in Northern Virginia, he says, get the biggest mortgage you can and try to never pay any principal on it.
Do you think he still says that?
I don't know. I think he closed, he closed his mortgage company, but it's, but his attitude, it's a mortgage planning, financial planning attitude that if you have a $300,000 home free and clear, you should take $290,000 out of that and invest it in the stock market to come up with a return on investment.
Successful loan originators,
right.
The best at the best times, how much are they making a year?
You would never want to be a loan officer full-time and make less than six figures. It was a foolish thing to do because it was 60 or 80 hours a week dealing with pressure from the top, which was the wholesalers and the underwriters, dealing with your processors, dealing with borrowers. It was just not a, well, you know, not anything you wanted to.
But tell me how much people made.
I didn't bring the. There's a publication. This publication went down the tube. But every April they would make a list of the top 200 loan officers around the country. Mm-hmm. That has been taken over by a publication called Scotsman Guide, mm-hmm. Scotsman, scotsmanguide.com. Mm-hmm. And in April they published their. They published their list of top originators. Mm-hmm. And many of the top originators, if you run the numbers thinking they make 1% or 2% per loan, can easily make seven figures a month, can make $1 million or more a month. That is absolutely not unheard of. But these are for the top, you know, 100 or 200 originators. So what Scotsman Guy did is they require tax forms to be submitted to them to verify. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if a particular originator did, you know, 500 loans in a year, you know, when you figure, you know, their average loan amount, let's say, is $300,000 and they make 2% on each loan front and back, then you pretty much know what their income is.
That's really a lot of money.
It's an extraordinary amount of money with no education requirements, up until recently, no licensing requirements. The problem is that it has been put forth as some kind of a financial planning counselor type of job when really it's just a sales job. Just I'm selling cars, I'm selling books, I'm selling mortgages. And in fact, one of the biggest trainers in the industry, his name is Todd Duncan, and he moved from a pure mortgage type of thing to a thing called sales mastery. This wasn't, you know, an earn more, high trust. This wasn't about helping your borrowers. It was about how you could master the sales process. And Todd then went on to write a number of different books just on sales in general.
Right.
So this was a sales job masked as a counseling job, I think.
If we go on Scotsman's Guide, we can see how much people are making and their names.
There's that historical. It's this past year. Yeah, it's not Scotsman's. It's Scotsman's Guide. Interestingly enough, many are making more this year because what's happened is volume continues to get better, and there are fewer and fewer loan officers left in the business. In some areas, Washington State just released results that I think fewer than half of the loan officers they thought would sign up for a license have done so. So there's been a significant cost.
How about like from, say, 2005 and 2006? Could we get those loan originator
You know, I don't know who bought the assets.
How much they make?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because it would be useful, because we'll, you know, one of the things we're doing is we're looking at how much the top executives at Countrywide made.
Right.
In fact, there were some mortgage originators that were probably making as much as a lot of executives at Countrywide.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this guy, Mike Midgett, he was a trainer. He said this is how one mortgage guy made $2.3 million in a year.
Right.
And, you know, clearly those were the huge numbers, but, you know, you can, and then you can, in each publication here, it looked at, okay, well, look, this is Rookie of the Month. And this was in June 2008, and they will give the actual numbers. So this rookie, Philip Tudisco at HSBC, his loan volume was $16 million. He's 25 years old. He did 152 units. So what's 1% of $16 million? Is that $1.6
million? No, that's
10%. So it would be 160,000. And this is his first year in the business. So he's 25 years old, and he made $160,000, if he only made 1 point. If he made 2 points, obviously he made $320,000. And then they usually have something about the veterans as well. But, you know,
So we went from a system where...
It was a bank loan officer.
You used to walk into the bank and apply for a mortgage.
That's right. And he knew you.
Yeah.
It was almost always a white man. He knew you. He was a vice president. And if he wrote loans that didn't perform, he'd get fired.
And when we started securitizing, all of a sudden, quality didn't matter nearly as much as quantity.
Right.
And it became a game of getting as many people out there beating the streets as you could get,
right,
selling loans. And then the type of loans started to evolve as well, to make them more affordable. And this is a depressing day for me because just before I came in here, I left an interview with an investment banker. Okay? George was there, and he was basically saying the securitization process was corrupt in the middle. Okay, the guys buying it knew they were buying bad loans, but they were only going to keep them on their books for a short period of time and get them out the door.
That's right, make money on the transaction.
And now you're telling me it was largely corrupt at the bottom. Did you ever stop and wonder why the investors are buying it?
No, it was a sap who would think that way. Only a sap. Yeah, only a sap.
How about sense? If you ever stopped that?
No, I mean, you know, yeah, I thought a lot about this. In fact, like I was telling Kirsten the other day, House of Cards was replayed on CNBC. Have you all seen that documentary on CNBC?
I haven't seen it. It's on the other night.
Yeah, it's on the other night. They replayed it. It's a wonderful...
The Fall of Lehman or something.
Yeah. Well, it was, and it was all about, you know, the mortgage industry. And we thought about it, but again, it's like anything else, like any relationship. You're like, who's at fault here? Who's at fault here? Who's to blame? And it is human nature, I think, to try to push that blame onto somebody else. That, look, you know, you told us you wanted these loans. We went out and knocked on doors in our neighborhoods and we got them for you. And now you're trying to blame us because we gave you what you wanted? You know, we delivered.
But the system only worked if there was somebody there willing to put really good money into them at the end.
Right.
You ever wonder why they did it?
Yeah.
Why they put good money in?
Right, because the rise of the middle class, we were told, and that's really it's interesting because that's a lot of what that documentary was about, the rise of the middle class in India and China, growing by the hundreds of millions, that the money would never stop, and that the safest securitization in the world was either treasuries or mortgage-backed securities in America, dollar-denominated. And that if you were an investor in China and an investor in India, you had demand, you had an appetite for risk, and you had a demand for return. And that if we're Lehman or whoever on Wall Street, and we're dealing with customers in India and China, they're saying, we need to buy these things. You know, there's not enough securities out there. We need more, and we need higher risk. And then you generate that, which will be securitized to create that risk.
I wanted to ask you about that the transition when all these new loans start to come in.
Right.
And you'd been in the business a long time. Right away, you knew a lot of these loans weren't going to make it, right?
No, I didn't. No,
you thought they would because housing prices would keep rising. You thought people would probably be okay.
Yeah.
Or they would be able to refinance out and go on.
Yeah.
So, but when this came in, right, when the loans changed, and because this was totally different than you'd ever seen before, why did you think, I mean, did you feel like the lenders were doing something that was potentially dangerous for them?
No, at that point, you know, to kind of deal with the macro question, I knew that risk was being shunted off. I knew that we could be writing crap, but in the end, it was like a game of musical chairs, and volume might go down, but we were not going to be hurt because they couldn't come back with repurchase requests onto loan officers and onto mortgage brokers. Our reps and warranties were such that unless there was fraud involved, and even if there was, if they made a repurchase request, we only had, you know, $10,000 in the bank or whatever, and we just declare bankruptcy. So there was never any recourse to us. These were, in all, for all intents and purposes, non-recourse activities for us.
One of the things that has been a question inside the commission is, why did this happen? And there is a school of thought that the Community Reinvestment Act,
right,
made like Wells Fargo and Bank of America go into this. What do you think about
it? It's outrageous. It's an outrageous and racist accusation. If you look at the numbers of CRA loans, it's just to me, that's just a proxy. And I'm not coming from a liberal or conservative point of view, but the numbers don't, they're just not there in terms of, if every CRA loan went bad, it still wouldn't have caused this crisis. And it's an outrageous, partisan, racist attack on an act that since 1977, I think, has done wonders for the country and has forced lenders to be more responsible. So it's
where,
clearly
where do you
partisan.
Think this came from?
It's from people who there has been a tremendous personalization of this crisis, isolated to Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, both of whom were strong supporters of Fannie and Freddie, both of whom were strong supporters of CRA. And the way you attack them, and the way you attack minorities, blacks in particular, and the way that you attack Democrats, is that you attack the CRA. And you say, this is not me, you know, attacking poor people or black people. This is just me attacking loans that shouldn't have been done.
Right.
But it's the most, it's the big, the Hitler big lie theory, that the more you tell it, the more people believe it. And there's the, just the, it's...
Well, let's just make it, then let's just say it outright.
Yeah.
This explosion of these new loans,
right,
had nothing to do with government regulation.
You couldn't get CRA credit for a subprime loan, as far as I know.
What it had to do was, it was an opportunity to make a buck, or
right,
make a lot of bucks,
right,
and that it was totally because everyone was being allowed to do it.
Absolutely. I think that's a good synopsis. But again, I don't know all the ins and outs of CRA, but let's find out if, when writing these subprime loans, did that give us CRA credit? And I don't think that it did. If it did, then fine.
Well, you never heard anybody say, countrywide, say, we need you to do this because,
right,
we want to be good citizens.
Well,
under the CRA.
Exactly. That was never the push. And mortgage brokers don't care about CRA because our CRA record doesn't get reported only as part of the lender's CRA. We're not subject to CRA. So we didn't care whether a loan met CRA requirements.
That's a very interesting.
Yeah, as far as I know, CRA does not filter down. We don't, you know.
CRA is a regulation that was passed originally when you used to sit behind a desk and that's the way you went in, you went in,
right,
and applied for a loan.
Yeah,
right.
And it was a fight against redlining, which we understood.
Is there anything that could have been done to stop this?
Become a communist or a socialist society rather than capitalist.
Well, how about, don't you think that
HUD
could have said these stated loan things are going to potentially cause a problem?
They tried. Again, if you look at that profile of Secretary Cuomo this morning in the Times, the mortgage brokers and bankers had tremendous political power that they don't have now. Tremendous. And they had brokers and bankers in every district.
You said the bankers, you're talking about the
mortgage bankers.
Like the Mortgage Bankers,
yeah,
Association.
Mortgage Bankers Association and the Mortgage Brokers Association. They were highly skilled, knew a lot about political pressure, and they could generate letters. They had a very good operation. And the big lie there is that if you restrict these loans, Mr. Secretary or Mr. President, you will keep people in Barney Frank's district from buying a home, in Connecticut from buying a home. And these are minorities that you will hurt and that you will not be able to buy a home. You will consign them to a lifetime of renting. And surely, Mr. President, surely, Mr. Secretary, you don't want to do that.
Well, you're just dampening economic growth.
Yeah, that's right. You are hurting people. You know, home ownership, we should have a 100% home ownership rate in this country. That's the ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. And if you do this, you will keep us from achieving those goals. But the big lie there is the subprime was almost exclusively a, and I hope this is made clear within the commission, almost exclusively a refinance per a business as opposed to purchase. That the way that the industry positioned it is, let us do these loans and we will get more people in homes. When in reality, these loans allowed more people to pull equity out of their homes. Mm-hmm. Did it increase the home ownership rate? Mike Calhoun at the Center for Responsible Lending, they have done some studies that showed, in fact, this reduced the eventual home ownership rate. Mm-hmm. And clearly, if you look at the black home ownership rate, which increased exponentially in the 90s, you will see that blacks and other minorities have been especially hard hit because they were subject to these subprime loans. And even if they were, these loans were used to get them into a home, the heartbreak is that you are not in a home anymore. We pull the rug out from under you.
Right. I did want to go back to this. Is there anything? I mean, I understand what you're saying about, you know, capitalist system and right. incentives and all that.
Yeah.
But what if you had been the head of HUD? If you had been at the FDIC, if you had been, what would you have done?
Nothing. I would have let this.
What would you have done if you had wanted it to be fixed? What if you had thought down the road? What if you had known what's happened?
Right. If I knew now what I knew now. I know it might be shocking, but even knowing what I know now, I'm not sure I would have stopped it because as a committed capitalist, I don't know if I would have wanted to get in the way. I want a capitalist system to have a recession and maybe even a depression because you take the bad with the good. And I don't know, as somebody who I don't, in terms of regulation, if I'm going to regulate during the boom times, who knows if I'm going too far. So if I had stopped option arms, okay, maybe, fine. But would that have stopped it? And, you know, and maybe there was some good here. So I don't know that I would have done anything. I don't know that I would have slipped into that stream and said, look, this is going to happen. I want there to be, if the price of capitalism is recessions and even a depression, I'm willing to pay that price. If the alternative is socialism or communism.
Well, but the one thing you did say earlier on, though, is that what you would like to see is everybody going to buy a house should know that the person sitting across the table from them is representing the lender's best interest, not theirs.
Here's the term I use is willful ignorance or willful negligence. I taught a home buying class at the Community College in North Carolina. It was an eight-week-long home buying class. It was aimed at poor people in Winston-Salem. We couldn't get anybody to attend. It was all yuppies who attended. Wachovia sponsored it. They spent millions of dollars on these classes around the state of North Carolina, maybe hundreds of thousands.
Because the poor people are not working.
Yeah, they were. Well, we would do it at night. I delivered it in North Salem doesn't have ghettos, but in the inner city, I delivered it in the inner city. We'd get 8 or 10 people at most to come to those classes. There is within America a laziness and a financial ignorance on our part that we don't want to learn. We spend more time investigating the aspects of plasma big screen TVs than we do home mortgages. I guess because we believe that it's beyond our ability. So why would you buy a home and make an investment that could total $1 million by the time you're making those payments and not go to an 8-hour home buying class? There's a website mortgage bankers created called homeloanlearningcenter.com. You might check with them on traffic numbers, homeloanlearningcenter.com. We on Bankrate, we have, I mean, you don't need to buy books anymore. It's all free on the internet. And so when borrowers would come to me, and say, not your books. That's not what I meant. I meant home buying books.
Right.
But if you're looking for how to buy a home, it's everywhere for free on the internet. And so when I have, I do a lot of loans in Bethesda, or I did until I started training full time in February. I would have the most educated people come to me, completely ignorant of the home buying and mortgage process. The belief apparently that it's just indecipherable when it's not.
Well, but when the products came in and they flew into the market, even you had to go get
tutoring.
Get tutor about it.
Yeah.
Because, the fact is that it was and then the numbers were surging. I mean, all these people had these mortgages before even the people who
We didn't
before,
know.
Before nobody, before even the leaders in the industry knew what was going on.
If you look at some of the sales stuff from AmeriQuest, you'll see that it's related to car buying. What we learned from the car business is that borrowers are concerned about one thing and one thing only. And you know what that is? Monthly payment.
Right.
It doesn't matter the price of the car, because I don't know about you all, I've never paid off a car in my life. 2 or 3 years into it, what am I doing? Buying a new car. I'm leasing that. I bought it. I'm making payments on it, but it's really a lease. Nobody in America buys a home. What do? We lease it. We never,
you know. You tell people that they're stupid to lease, and then you end up leasing them out.
They only lease it. The question I always ask my students who have, you know, over the years, since I've been training for about 20 years, nobody knows the answer to this question. Some of you have some age on you here in this room, but what did your parents and grandparents, they paid off their 30-year loan. What kind of a party did they have? Don't answer. They see if they know. What kind of a party did they have?
A mortgage burning party.
You didn't. Have you ever heard that term?
Yeah,
Your parents or grandparents did?
Yeah.
They
got the piece of paper and they sat and they burned it.
It's a mortgage burning party. And most, I'd say 90% of the loan originators I teach have never heard of that term.
Right.
So what we understood in the mortgage business is if we could get you into a home with little or no money down,
right,
and you could make the monthly payment, you would take that loan regardless of its features.
But is that because the model has changed where back when, well, I guess my parents, my grandparents, that what you do, you bought your home, you lived in it for 30 years, and you needed equity.
Well, you didn't have a credit card to live on.
You didn't have a credit card. My father got sick. He eventually got better, but he got sick in the 1970s, and he had to take out a second mortgage. The reason I know it's a second mortgage is if you look at any of the advertising over the years for home equity loans or home equity lines of credit, they never say second mortgage. Mm-hmm. Because the term, talk to your grandparents, the term second mortgage was a pejorative. Mm-hmm. My father, they had, you know, my mother and six kids, they ran out of money. He was a state employee, ran out of money. He had to get a second mortgage. When he got better, the first thing he did was pay that off. And there was great shame within our family that my father had to get a second mortgage, because the goal is to own a home free and clear in this country, at least it was. And so we understood that because incomes hadn't shot up, Freddie Mac has got some figures that show that home values started to shoot up in the late 90s, but income did not. And so you had fairly stagnant income, and home prices, whether it was because of immigrants or because it was demand, started to really shoot up. And so what we needed to do is bridge that affordability gap.
Yeah.
And the way that you do that, in the old days we had 28-36 ratios where 28% of your gross monthly income could go to housing, and then another 8% on top of that for credit cards, student loan, personal loans, and car loans. But most people nowadays spend about 20% of their income on credit cards, student loans, personal loans, and car loans. And so the old model, the old 28-36 model, didn't work anymore. And so we had to increase those ratios. Then when that didn't work, we had to do the stated income loans.
Let me ask you kind of a follow-up to your question. Is this going to happen again, being that we ignored the lessons of the S&L crisis?
Right.
It was a different type of loans that were being used.
Right.
The stated income still kind of played a role.
Right.
And because there's a lack of institutional knowledge, I guess it will, because no one's in the industry for a long time.
Right.
Is this going to happen again?
There's a company in Rockville called ACC Mortgage. It stands for All Credit Considered Mortgage. And their website is weapproveloans.com. Subprime lending is back with them. If you put 30% down, you can do a stated income loan. So the answer to your question is, not only is it coming back, it's already back.
It never went away.
Never went away with private placements now.
Took a nap.
Yeah, that's right. But if you look at the 2006 statement on subprime lending from the five federal agencies and the 2007 guidance on non-traditional mortgages, the guidance is really an attack on deferred interest loans, and the statement is really an attack on subprime ARM loans. So I'd encourage you to read those. I'm sure you have access, and they're available on the Internet. So it's the 2006 statement of the 2007 guidance. And basically what it's saying is, you know, we were asleep at the switch. Took us till 2006, 2007 to know what was going on. If these loans ever come back, they're not going to have many of the onerous provisions that they had. So deferred interest is pretty much out. Prepayment penalties, balloon loans, those are, for all intents, considered predatory. Will subprime come back? Yes, But in the type of market we have, I mean, I don't know. That guidance and statement may end up being repealed. Who knows? And so this can come back.
Can I ask you a question
about some aspects? Some aspects are gone, though. Deferred interest, prepayment penalty. What else did you say?
Well, deferred interest, prepayment penalty,
balloon,
non-escrowing on subprime.
Right.
So there's all this demand that the onerous features be eliminated, but Americans, a certain subset of Americans, will always have bad credit.
So this is in the guidances.
If you read the guidances,
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's extraordinary, and I know the Office of Thrift Supervision is going away, but if you think about those five federal agencies, FDIC, the Fed, NCUA, got together. When those five federal agencies got together and issued guidance that they all agreed on, it was extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
So I really think it's incumbent even to make them a part of an appendix. So the answer is yes, it's coming back, but will it be securitized? That's the question. You know, will there be a demand? If there's a demand for this type of loan, then if they're from India, from China, or from wherever, if there's a demand for the mortgage, for the securities backed by these types of loans, then absolutely they will come back with a fury.
That's a good thing, because you said you were a dedicated capitalist.
Yeah.
As a result of the corruption at the bottom,
right,
the corruption in the middle, capitalists lost hundreds of billions of dollars, and they weren't all Chinese and Indians either.
Right.
And they really, it happened when loans went from what was traditionally a highly regulated banking sector into a largely unregulated security sector. If you had to stop it, if you were the head of the SEC, could you stop it?
I'm glad they lost, because that the fact that they lost means that they took risks. And there was a, who was the guy that made $1 billion in a day betting against subprime?
It was probably Paulson.
Paulson. So they gained. And so I'm glad there's something. Capitalism is going to be winners and losers, not mandated by anybody but the market.
But he gained by betting on loans that he pretty much knew were going to fail.
Yeah.
And he wasn't betting on the fact
But Paulson was a bet.
Right.
Two guys standing on the sidelines watching the capital system, one lost.
Yeah.
But the underlying losses was real money, real capital disappearing.
Yeah.
Based on people who funded what had become a corrupt system.
Yeah. And that's a strong word. I don't know if the word is corrupt. I don't know. I mean, I know that it's... It was flawed, but was it flawed? I mean, it certainly worked for a while. No, so flawed in the long term, but in the short term, you know, people got equity out of their homes. Loan officers made millions, and, you know, if we're all about short term in this country, then it was a very successful system.
I was going to ask you about, when you were talking about training, and you were talking about trying to train in a way that you were making it clear what the law,
right,
you know, encouraging them to understand what the law was.
Right.
Do you know, just anecdotally, how often it was that you were knowledgeable about any kind of crackdown for illegality, breaking the law, skirting the law, fraud?
My kind of mantra had always been that you never get visited by the state regulators unless there's a story in the newspaper that bubbles up from lawsuits or the Better Business Bureau, that the regulators are reactive. I owned a mortgage brokerage license in North Carolina for 9 years and never once was visited by a regulator from Raleigh.
Not even a regulator. What, I mean, did you ever call law enforcement?
I was never, you know, a witness to this type of fraud. And then the question becomes, you know, is that our duty if you see fraud? You know, what is ultimately the, you know, the duty? Is a, if I'm hearing a guy in the cubicle next to me committing fraud, do I have the duty to my company?
Is that working?
I think ethically, no. I think it's a pretty clear black and white issue that
did
you do have that
turn
duty. No, I never. I was kind of a lone wolf. I was always operating on my own. I was never engaged in that type of fraud.
But what about a loan officer that you employed?
I only had a few loan officers. I rode herd over them pretty closely, and I was never, I mean, I the FBI says they have 3,000 active cases of mortgage fraud nationwide as we sit today. And I don't know if that means individuals committing fraud. We had a large case in Prince George's County. I don't know if that means companies committing fraud. I don't know what that is. I don't want to be to understate it. Clearly, it was fraud going on in terms of, you know, as the gentleman was saying, the borrower says, I make $14,000 a year. We have to say you make $150,000 a year. But why did the recession happen because of fraud? You know, the crisis happened because of fraud or because of product? And I just don't know.
So all your years in the business, you've never made any referral to any authority of any suspicions of fraud?
Or have you told a lender? I mean, yeah. Granted, as a broker, you don't have the responsibility, the regulatory.
Right.
But the lender does. Have you ever told the lender, listen, I'm sending you this loan,
right,
but I think there's fraud in it?
No, I was an aggressive type of pre-underwriter, you know, as a loan officer, and so I never would have sent anything like that forward. I mean, I was not a major player in subprime.
And also. Yeah. You've been a trainer.
Yeah, well, I've been a trainer and an originator, but I mean, I was never sitting in an office saying, okay. For instance, Ameriquest had what they used to call an art department. Have you ever heard of the Ameriquest art department?
Mm-hmm.
And every branch they had an art department. They had windows like that, and the art department was where they would either do tracings or they would create documents. And you would go in there and you could smell the whiteout. So there was clear fraud involved in some Ameriquest loans. But I was—I don't know whether it's just that.
How did you know this?
There are a number of lawsuits. I'll try to send you some links, but they specifically refer to the Ameriquest Art Department.
But you didn't know this person.
No, I didn't.
You came to know it because of your business.
The business. Although okay. I would go into offices like the Louisville office of Ameriquest, Louisville, Kentucky, and every 3 or 6 months they'd bring me back to train new loan officers, and loan officers who had been fired, they would just kind of, you know, bring them in, bring them out. And so there were these instances of, you know, of fraud. And the interesting thing is fraud occurs when things are slow and also when they're fast, because when things are very busy, you have underwriters who are just kind of rubber stamping things. Additionally, if you have DU and LP from Fannie and Freddie, if you have automated underwriting system approval, you're not going to worry too much about the details because you've got a loan that you know you can sell to Fannie and Freddie. So there's not, you will hear this anecdotal evidence from underwriters who were fired or who were, you know, relieved of duty because they were too strict on the underwriting mm-hmm. guidelines. It's just like, this is a loan. You would hear instances of the sales and marketing person being in charge of the underwriting department, which was just a clear violation of any, you know, management.
So what about loans that got flagged as being fraud suspected or fraud probable that ended up getting approved?
If you look at a list
at the lender level, but
yeah, if you look at a list and you can see it, go into Google and type in mortgage red flags, you'll see all these red flags. But ultimately, the question is, you know, how do you approve that fraud? How do you prove that fraud? And if you're an underwriter and the sales and marketing person over you is saying, look, we've committed to sending Wells 100 loans this month, and just get them done. Then there's a disincentive for you to be a strict underwriter, and there's an incentive for you to rubber stamp stuff and just get it done.
Yeah, borrowers did tell me, though, that, you know, since it was so easy to get stated income loans,
right.
You know, why was it necessary for people
right.
to do fraud
yeah.
in some cases? I
right.
mean, but in fact, people told me that they submitted papers and they were said, go back and change it, or things were changed on their documents.
Yes, and that's the distinction, because those would not have been stated income loans, because those would have been clear of any income. What you had was those would have been, if it was no income, no asset, you wouldn't have stated anything.
Right.
But the fraud occurred where the borrower said, I make $14,000 a year, and then the loan officer said, no, in order to qualify for this loan, you have to make $60,000 a year. It's what we would call backing into it. So, for instance, they would tell us the ratios that were required. So they would say the maximum back-end ratio on this deal allowed is 50% of gross. So let's say that they were making $5,000 a month. Mm-hmm. The maximum allowable housing payment plus all of their other payments, credit cards, student loans, personal loans, and car loans, couldn't total more than $2,500.
Right.
So we totaled up what they wanted for principal, interest, taxes, and insurance, and their debts, and it equaled $3,500.
And while people were flipping, there was lots of that because they had piled up a huge...
A lot of debt.
Huge debt compared to their income.
And so if they said the maximum DTI is 50%, and we found that their, you know, gross, that was $3,500, then we would have to report their gross as $7,000. So what we would do is, rather than taking the borrower, not we, but you know, the industry, rather than taking the borrower's existing information, we would try to squeeze it into the parameters of the loan. So that was pretty clear. If you want this loan approved, you cannot have a higher than 50% DTI. If your total debt is $3,500, you've got to report $7,000 or more.
So, but given that there were all these mortgages,
right,
you could, it almost seems kind of stupid to actually commit fraud. You can just find some loan that you can squeeze them into.
Well, yeah, but because the rate would be much higher.
The rate would be higher.
Or on a no income. I mean, the higher, the less information you provided, the higher the rate and the less acceptable that would be to the borrower. So rather than putting them into a no income, no asset, you lie about their stated income, stated asset, and get them a rate of 0.2.
If they were flipping, though, and you were encouraged to think that the value was going to hold or go up, that wouldn't impact them.
Yeah, they because again, if they could make that payment that month, they knew that every month the home was increasing 1% in value,
sure,
or 0.5% in value, and that was going to rescue them.
You have some other questions, but I don't want to forget one thing. We'd love it if you would give us a statement about. I'd love it if you'd give us a statement how many people you train per year in each of these years, and for which all which companies. And I'd like you to say, did anyone ever say they needed you to make these loans for Community Reinvestment Act? At any point were you ever told that this was to meet Community Reinvestment Act requirements or government requirements of loans to be offered to minorities? What I'd like you to do is tell us what everybody told you they needed you to train all these mortgage originators for.
At what point, we need to talk, I have a really good quote that will help you. You have that scenario where the person comes in making $14,000 a year and the loan officer says, well, you can't qualify this, you need to make X. And the loan officer ends up funding that loan. At what point do you cross the line between fraud versus predatory lending, or is predatory lending a type of fraud?
I wouldn't call it that. I mean, predatory is predatory. I think it sits on its own. Where you committed fraud is when you tell the borrower, when you put on the application form higher than what they told you. That's, to me, clear-cut fraud. And then at application and at closing, when the borrower signs that document, and then afterwards they say, well, that's what they put on there, so I felt I had to sign it. So it was fraud on the part of the borrower, too.
And also owner-occupant. If people were actually buying it and they were investors and they said they were owner-occupants, that would be another area of fraud.
Right, straw buyer, absolutely.
But if you're not disclosing aspects of the deal that you know to be true, it's a material omission.
Right.
Which, I mean, it fits in the FBI's definition of mortgage fraud.
Right.
Could you classify predatory lending or types of predatory lending as they're known as fraud?
I don't mix those two.
Where do you cut the line between mortgage fraud versus predatory lending?
Well, to me, the FBI identifies fraud as fraud for property and fraud for profit. So fraud for property is where you're lying, but you intend to occupy that property. You can't qualify, but you still want to make the payments, and those could be performing loans. Mm-hmm. You know, fraud for profit is a completely another issue, and the types of loans that get you into that fraud position, to me, it's a separate argument. I guess the issue is predatory lending. Have you committed a fraud upon the borrower? Is that kind of where you're trying to get to there? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you're concealing an aspect of the deal, whether it's that, you know, you could qualify for conventional loan, but I'm going to put you in this non-conforming.
Yeah, that to me is I don't know what you would call that. I mean, you know, is that a violation? I mean, you sell a car for $15,000 that you have sold to somebody earlier that day for $14,000. You know, have you committed fraud upon that car buyer, that $15,000 car buyer? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. You know, how can you be accused of violating a fiduciary duty that you don't have? But at the same time, when you're calling somebody your client and we're saying we'll shop the rate for you and we're going to, you know, implying fiduciary duty, can you be violating a duty that you don't have? I don't know. That's a legal question. Yeah.
Does anybody else have anything they wanted to add?
No.
You've been incredibly helpful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Before you wait,
could
we ask you to just introduce you? We would have done it in the beginning, but
no problem. My name is Christopher Cruise, C-R-U-I-S-E. I guess I'd identify myself as a trainer of loan officers.
For how many years?
I've been in the business since 1988, and I've been a trainer probably since about 1990, but a full-time trainer really when the boom started in about 2002 and 2003, in addition to being an originator. So I've always originated at that same time I've trained.
And have you always been in this line of work?
Broadcasting and training. So I guess journalism and mortgage as well. Yeah, both. Yeah. And then... And just since February, I've morphed into a compliance trainer where I'm training the 20-hour class, helping people to comply with the SAFE Act. And that might be a significant part of your report as well, that for the first time ever, there are now national barriers to getting into the business. You have to have a criminal check, a credit check, and you have to take a 20-hour course in most states. In some states, it's more than 20 hours. And you have to pass a national and state exam. So it's the same thing that's been the case in real estate for maybe 40 or 50 years. So you can no longer go from flipping burgers in the morning to originating loans in the afternoon, which still is the case in many states and will be until the end of the year. And you can be, unfortunately, you can be a convicted murderer and still get a license so long as you haven't had a felony conviction in the past 7 years. But if you've had a felony conviction involving fraud or money laundering anytime, anywhere in the world, you can never get a license. So there are, for the first time, some restrictions in the business to enter.
So that's a piece of good news for borrowers.
Well, it is, but it's also, I mean, it was passed as part of HERA, the Housing and Economic Recovery Act in 2008, this so-called SAFE Act. Mel Martinez actually wrote it. He was the HUD secretary and then the Florida senator. And the NAMB has always supported licensing. But it's kind of sort of an indictment of the states that the states didn't create, I mean, most of the states didn't require loan officers to be licensed. And so if you don't have a license and you commit fraud or you do bad to your borrowers, the state in many cases can't stop you from doing that because they have nothing to revoke. So for the first time now, we've got licenses for loan officers at non-depositories, and there's a website called NMLSConsumerAccess.org that's actually up and live. That's going to show the employment record, and it's going to show any disciplinary actions. So I think that probably is the, you know, Housing and Economic Recovery Act is a direct result of the financial implosion. And then licensing of loan officers and registration of bank loan officers is a reaction, I think, to this. So all 50 states, all the territories in D.C., because they didn't do it as a unit. Mm-hmm. And so finally the federal government had to step in. Mm-hmm. And so for the first time, they'll be tracking. So you can be a bad actor today in Nevada and move to California and get a loan officer's license or move to some other state and work as a loan officer. So the company that's running the backbone of that is actually FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which, as you know, tracks stockbrokers and financial planners and that type of thing. So finally, we've got professionalism. As to whether that'll make a difference, I don't know. The SAFE Act also has an interesting provision, something we've been talking about, that requires the loan officer to act in the best interest of the borrower. So if you would read the SAFE Act, you will see that. What is the best interest of the borrower? Is that fiduciary light? It's like being a little bit pregnant. You're either a fiduciary or you're not. And so what is the best interest of the borrower?
That's available. It could be getting them a home or it could be not giving them a loan.
So that has yet to be fleshed out by HUD, I think. They're issuing some final rules as to how you define best interest. Is it suitability? Is it fiduciary? Is it getting them the lowest rate available? Is it getting them the lowest costs? That'll be the question.
And should we go? Are we supposed to go around the table?
I think we should.
Say who's here.
George Wall, FCIC.
Alexis Sevendinger, FCIC.
Kirsten Downey, FCIC.
Bob Inkley, FCIC.
Tom Stanton was here but stepped out about a half hour ago.
FCIC.
FCIC.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay,
very
my pleasure.
Much. Excellent.
Can I get your new email address?
You sure can.
Thank you. Stop. You are